Appalachian State University is perhaps best known for having defeated the University of Michigan's football team some years back. But it's also a place that takes its academic mission very seriously. The search for truth, for knowledge, and its dissemination, free and open debate. Indeed, Appalachian State has an annual event called Say What, where they face squarely some of the most difficult questions of campus free speech. I was honored recently to be invited to give the keynote address there and to moderate a panel, even to appear on a podcast at Appalachian State. And today I'm going to share with you my experiences there. It's your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week it's about campus free speech and say what?
Welcome to your weekly constitutional, underwritten by the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier. Your host is Professor Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Duncan School of Law of Lincoln Memorial University.
Free speech on university and college campuses is a huge issue, not just from a constitutional perspective, but from an academic perspective. And as perhaps you've gathered over the years, if you're a regular listener, I'm a great proponent of free inquiry, free speech, and academic freedom. So I was thrilled to receive an email recently from a woman named Leonie Kruger, who works at Appalachian State University in Western North Carolina, a place I'd never visited, despite living nearby for a number of years. She and her colleagues Jonathan Hyde welcomed me with open arms to an event called Say What, which is a week-long event devoted to issues of campus free speech. I got to moderate a panel discussion, including a number of scholars and administrators and students. I got to give a keynote address and have field questions from students and academics and members of the public. And I also got to appear on a wonderful podcast called Sound Affect, A-F-F-E-C-T, that's run by the University Communications Department and hosted by a woman named Megan Hayes. Here's part of my interview with Megan.
Constitutional law professor and radio show host Stuart Harris is a former environmental, civil rights, and First Amendment attorney who has advised the Army Corps of Engineers on civil works projects throughout the continental United States, including drafting congressional testimony for the Assistant Secretary of the Army for Civil Works. In private practice, he concentrated on environmental, civil rights, and First Amendment law, notably obtaining $500,000 for a public official who had been libeled by a newspaper. Harris is a law professor in the Duncan School of Law at Lincoln Memorial University in Harrogate, Tennessee. He graduated from Princeton University in 1983 and has taught law at institutions throughout the Southeast since 1999. He also hosts a nationally syndicated public radio show, one I thoroughly enjoy listening to, called Your Weekly Constitutional, which is produced by WETS, a national public radio station in the Tri-Cities, Tennessee, Virginia region. Harris is on our campus as part of a week-long series of events devoted to discussing the First Amendment and, in particular, matters of free speech and expression on our college campus. We would like to keep this discussion going beyond this week, and so we've asked him to join us in the podcast studio to think through some questions submitted by our students, faculty, and staff. Stuart Harris, welcome to Appalachian State University, and welcome to Sound Effect.
Megan, it is an honor, and especially an honor, to meet a loyal listener.
Excellent. Well, I enjoy the show very much. And it's a real treat to have you here. Last night, you hosted a panel discussion. We had faculty, students, student development professionals. We had legal experts. And they were all debating some really interesting questions. They're relevant to our campus. I believe they're also relevant to college campuses across the United States. So I wanted to continue that discussion now, if we could, or begin it for those who weren't there last night. And one of the things I wanted to do was just start with the basics, which we did cover last night, but I think it's great to kind of set the tone. So what rights are afforded Americans under the First Amendment? And also what rights are restricted? And if you could talk a little bit about what the historical and legal basis is for those restrictions.
Sure. The First Amendment is deceptively short. It's 45 words. And it reads, I hope I get this right, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or infringing freedom of speech or of the press, or the right of the people to peaceably assemble and petition the government for a redress of grievances. Now, there are five different, depending on how you count them up, freedoms that are in there. And as you can tell, they are five of the most cherished freedoms we have. I mean, religion is probably one of the most important things to people. whether they are religious or not. I mean, people who are atheists or agnostic also hold their beliefs very strongly, frequently. Freedom of speech, freedom of the press are essential to the functioning of our governmental system, and they're also very much a part of our personal autonomy. And people rightly get upset when anyone tries to tell them what they can or cannot say. And then assembly, of course. Assembly is one of the ways that we get together and protest the government or protest other things or simply express our opinion about something. And then, of course, being able to go to our government and say, hey, this is a problem, through a petition or some other means, is one of the most important rights that we have as Americans. So that's why the First Amendment is identified by many people as being the single most important part of the Constitution of the United States.
I would just like to take a moment, because people are not in the studio and could not see that you recited the entire First Amendment without looking at anything.
Well,
that's pretty impressive.
I probably made a mistake or two along the way in terms of the words, but I think we did identify the five freedoms that are there. And as I said, it's a very short amendment, so you don't have to go on at great length in order to say something very important.
One of the things that you hear people say all the time is, oh, you can't yell fire in a crowded movie theater. So there are some restrictions on that speech. Can you talk a little bit about that and what kind of the basis is for restricting those?
Sure. If we want to focus on freedom of speech, I'll first acknowledge that the Supreme Court opinions in this area are very complicated. It's often considered to be one of the most difficult parts of constitutional law, in addition to one of the most fascinating. One way to look at freedom of speech is to start out from the absolute that the text of the amendment actually suggests. Congress shall make no law infringing freedom of speech or of the press. Now, some people simply say no law means no law, and we call them First Amendment absolutists. But most of us, including the Supreme Court, would make certain exceptions. For example, secret codes, classified information. We are restricted by our government from revealing such things. And repeatedly, the Supreme Court has said there's a national security exception to the First Amendment. That's very important. Another area that's highly relevant in this whole debate of speech on campus is something called a true threat. If I actually threaten to harm you, and a reasonable person would see that as me actually on the verge of smacking you or doing something bad to you, that's something that the state can also prohibit and punish. And finally, incitement to violence. If I were to turn to a third party and say, there's Megan, go get her, hit her over the head. And if that person was right there and had something to hit you over the head with, and there was a likelihood of imminent harm, that's something that also could be punished. So you see, we've identified already three exceptions to it, and there are others as well.
Is the right to freedom of speech, does it differ on a college campus than it does elsewhere?
Not really. All of the Constitution, all of the amendments, all of the individual rights identified in the Constitution limit what the government can do. And that's something that's extremely important. Do you remember that controversy we had over Duck Dynasty a few years ago when a fellow said some pretty unpleasant things and the network fired him from the show? Well, fans of the show immediately said, freedom of speech, that's unconstitutional. Well, no, it wasn't. That's a private entity, and they can hire and fire people pretty much as they please, and they can fire them for saying things that they don't like. But if it's the government, and remember, we're at Appalachian State University, so it's part of the government, well, then the First Amendment does apply. And so if Appalachian State tries to regulate speech on campus, well, then there's going to be an issue. And we're going to have to evaluate whether that's something it can or cannot do.
That's a really good segue to what I was going to ask next, which you may have already answered. But one of the questions I think that comes up a lot, and we see this where college campuses, you know, we're in academia, we look to other colleges, what are they doing? We have private colleges that'll come out with somewhat restrictive, at least practices, if not policies. So we look to those, and as a public entity, we say, this probably isn't something we can do as a public institution. Can you talk a little bit about the differences between the private colleges and public colleges and what regulates them?
Sure. There are both similarities and differences. Private, of course, means non-governmental. And so, strictly speaking, the Constitution does not restrict the ability of a private college to regulate speech on its campus. On the other hand, there are some federal statutes, typically having to do with the availability of student loans, etc., that effectively force colleges to respect free speech to a similar degree on their campuses as state universities have to do. Probably the biggest exception to that is religious institutions. So, for example, if you have a Catholic university that does not want anyone on its faculty who is a supporter of choice, of abortion rights, then in all likelihood, that Catholic university is going to be able to discharge a professor who proposes those sorts of things. Now, the professor might say, hey, that's my free speech right. But the Catholic university will say, no, this is our free exercise of religion. And that's going to trump whatever free speech rights you have. And by the way, we're a private entity. We're the Catholic Church. And so the Constitution doesn't apply here anyway.
We're going to file this under one of those things I should remember from my high school civics class.
We all should have paid more attention, shouldn't we?
Well, and I will say it's been a while. can you change an amendment to the Constitution? And what does it take to do that? And you talked about interpretation of amendments, but are they malleable?
Oh, absolutely. The Constitution contains an article, Article 5, which mandates several different methods by which the Constitution can be changed. The one that's always been used for every one of the 27 times the Constitution's been amended has been a two-stage process. The first stage has been in Congress, where two-thirds of each House of Congress have to agree upon a proposed amendment. Once that is achieved, and that's a very difficult thing to do, can you imagine trying to get this current Congress, two-thirds of them to agree on anything, then that proposed amendment is sent out to the states. Now, three-quarters of the states must now ratify this, and it's the state legislatures in each case. And that's another enormous bar, which is often failed, people fail to achieve. In fact, one of the more recent examples is back in the 1970s when something called the Equal Rights Amendment was approved by the requisite two-thirds majority in both houses of Congress, but failed to ever get the required three-quarter states ratification.
So there is a lot of discussion on our campus and, quite frankly, campuses across the country about hate speech. And one of our students in a question defined hate speech as offensive language or anything negative toward another person to demean them or dehumanize them. Is hate speech defined under the law?
No, it is not. There is no definition of hate speech. And moreover, the Supreme Court has repeatedly held that things that many of us would probably consider hate speech is actually protected by the United States Constitution. A recent case is the case of Snyder versus Phelps, or Phelps versus Snyder, I forget which it was, where a very hateful group that calls itself the Westboro Baptist Church, which is known for having signs with very offensive language on them, like God hates fags, things of that sort. That group has a crazy theory that God is punishing America for its support of gay rights, and it's punishing us in a very specific way by God is killing our soldiers who are overseas. And following this twisted logic, these people show up at the funerals of American service members with their hate-filled speeches, including some like, your son or daughter is burning in hell. Can you imagine if you lost a son or a daughter and some hateful person showed up and was saying things of that sort? I mean, they're obviously doing it for publicity. Mr. Snyder, the father of an American serviceman who was being so treated, or I should say his funeral was being so treated, actually sued Phelps, the Reverend Phelps, the head of the Westboro Baptist Church, on the basis of, I think it was intentional infliction of emotional distress. He won his case, the father did, at the trial level, but it was reversed. Went all the way to the Supreme Court, which upheld the reversal, and get this, the grieving father of the American serviceman had to pay more than $40,000 in legal fees to these hateful people because the Supreme Court said this was such a clear principle of American law that hateful speech like this was protected.
Wow.
Yes, wow indeed. I mean, it's often said that the First Amendment, it's not necessary to protect popular speech. It's hateful speech, or I should say offensive speech or unpopular speech, that requires First Amendment protection. And that brings us back to the definition that one of your students offered for hate speech. Anything that's offensive, how do you define that?
Right.
What offends me might not offend you and vice versa. Anything that demeans another person, well, you've now just outlawed about 90% of current political rhetoric. Anything that targets a person because of his or her identity, well, now we're actually getting closer to something that I think we can discuss. Of all the things that the First Amendment currently protects, that I think one could make an argument should be somehow restricted, or the Constitution should allow restrictions, are speech that is directed at a person because of who that person is. So if I were to attack you because, I don't know your religion, but let's just say you're Jewish. Anti-Semitism is in the air these days. If I were to attack you because you're white, if I were to attack you because you are a woman, now arguably, you have no control over any of that. I mean, you were born Jewish, you're born white, you're born a woman. And I'm attacking your position in the body politic as a member of society on that basis. That, I think, is probably the closest anyone's ever come to a workable definition of hate speech. Could we outlaw, or should we be able to outlaw that type of speech? There's an ongoing debate over that right now. And though I tend to be very much close to the free speech absolutist position, and I quail at any restrictions by the government on speech, I understand we're seeing the rise, especially of right-wing hate groups right now, and we're seeing a resurgence in anti-Semitism fueled by the internet. It's very frightening what's going on about it. And it's not just here, it's all over the world. I never thought we'd have another decade like the 1930s. I thought we'd learned our lessons. I thought we'd beaten the Nazis, but the Nazis never really left, did they? I've not changed my position yet on hate speech, but I'm willing to listen and have people convince me that maybe there's something we could be able to do about it if we define it narrowly enough.
Right. And I think that leads into this next question, which several members of our campus community asked, and I'm consolidating those questions because there were several along these lines, about asking what is that line between free speech and creating a safe learning environment. And so when we talk about words and what makes us feel safe or what makes us feel unsafe, do words actually make us unsafe?
I will quibble with the choice of the word safe, because I personally don't think that making people feel safe is part of the mission of a university. Please let me explain. I prefer the word inclusion. I believe everybody, every student, every member of the faculty, and to a great extent, every member of the public should feel welcome at a university. But the reason I don't use the word safe is because once they get there, I want to challenge them. I want to challenge them with ideas that are maybe completely diametrically opposed to theirs, and ideas that might make them feel extremely uncomfortable. I want to do it in a civil environment, and I don't want to attack anybody individually, but I want to talk about things that are near and dear to people's hearts and challenge assumptions that they've probably had in many cases since childhood. So I don't like the idea of a safe space. I like the idea of an inclusive, respectful space, a civil space in which we can have the sort of discourse that a university arguably exists for.
Well, that was part of Megan Hayes' interview of me on her podcast at Appalachian State called Sound Effect, and that's with an A, Sound Affect, A-F-F-E-C-T. Go ahead and Google it. Google Sound Affect at Appalachian State. You can listen to the rest of that interview, and believe me, it's worth it because Megan's a great interviewer, and you can also, of course, access many other fabulous episodes. After the break, we will go to a panel discussion that I moderated at Appalachian State, where some very, very interesting ideas were bandied about by a lot of people who knew a lot about them. Stick around. You're listening to Your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week I'm taking you along with me on a trip to Boone, North Carolina, where I visited Appalachian State University for an event called Say What, all about campus free speech. There I met a fellow by the name of Jonathan Hyde. He's the Vice Chancellor and Dean of Students, and he introduced me to a panel of prominent people, lawyers and university officials and even some students, who are going to be talking about some of the most difficult free speech issues facing campuses today. Well, how the hell are you? I can say that, right? Free speech? Yeah, even at a state university, absolutely. It's a great pleasure to be here this evening. It's a great honor. I hope that some of you will be able to come tomorrow evening when we're going to have a very interesting discussion of these issues. Right now, however, the stars of the show are our panelists who are going to be taking your questions. So let me introduce them, please. Dr. Michael Barrett, who's just arrived. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you.
Is an associate professor of history here at Appalachian State. He received his PhD from New York University and teaches European intellectual history, modern French history, and modern European history. His research interests include the place of religion in French political thought and Michel Foucault. Did I pronounce that correctly?
Michel, but it's fine.
Michel, okay, well, omelette du fromage, that's all I know how to say in French, okay.
Excellent.
Excellent, okay. J. Spencer Darden
has been involved in student affairs and equity work since 2012 and currently serves as the Associate Director for Multicultural Student Development at Appalachian, Jared Mark. Next in line is a third-year honors political science major. He is currently serving as the Director of Student Affairs for Appalachian Student Government Association. He also acts as the coordinator of governmental proceedings for the Residence Hall Association, and he dedicates service to the Appalachian family as an Appalachian student ambassador. Paul Meggett began serving as Appalachian's general counsel on June 18th, 2018. Prior to coming to Appalachian, he served as a law professor and interim dean. I'm so sorry. That's a tough job. Interim dean with the Charlotte School of Law. Toussaint Romain, did I pronounce that correctly? Romain?
Yes.
Okay. Is a public defender in Charlotte, North Carolina. Romain became a key figure, civil rights leader, and peacekeeper during the protests of the shooting of Keith Lamont Scott in September of 2016. Romain is a community advocate who has spoken across the nation, taught continuing legal education courses, and developed community initiatives for his local community. Gabby's with us. Gabby Romero is a second-year anthropology major. Anthropology, that's the study of humanity, right? So you're studying everything.
Yeah.
Okay, good. I just want to get that clear. That's our panel. Please welcome them. Thank you all for coming. The first question this evening is, what rights do Americans have under the First Amendment? And I was suggested that maybe Toussaint or Paul would like to take the lead on this one, but all the panelists are invited to participate.
Thanks again for having me here. I would tell you that First Amendment rights really fall into five big categories, right? There's a freedom of religion, freedom of speech, there's the freedom of press, the freedom to assemble peacefully, and the freedom to address your government for grievances, right? To say, hey, you wronged me and I need a chance to fix this. And that these rights come from a place where the King of England was really killing people, saying you had to be this particular religion. You couldn't gather, and if I decided to kill you, you couldn't debate this or have any issues. And so the Founding Fathers back in 1787, when they were creating the Constitution and then the Bill of Rights, what we call our amendments, decided to create these big five. They're not always what you think they are. I think the two attorneys up here will give you more of the legal perspective. At least I will offer that to you. And I think you'll hear from others as to how it actually works in practice. And it's a little different, and it's hard to really know the difference or what it is until you get in some trouble, I think, right? So, but those are the big five. The reason and the rationale behind these big five amendments is simply this. The bedrock principle is that of viewpoint neutrality. Basically, we want everyone under the freedom of expression, freedom of speech, to have the ability to believe what they want to believe and to say what they want to say. We'll get into some restrictions or exceptions here briefly, but again, it's all about being content neutral. You have a right to like Duke, you have a right to like Chapel Hill, right? And in more relevant terms, you have a right to say, I hate Jewish people, or you have a right to say, I love Jewish people. And our Constitution, from a legal perspective, wants to allow folks the right to be able to say those things. Now, you may hear from others whether it's right or wrong, and we'll get into the morality of saying, I hate Jewish people. But the Constitution wants to protect things like that so that folks have the right to speak and also the right not to speak. It's interesting in that particular regard. Anything you would add or correct?
One of the things that I think I would add is maybe a practical perspective is the notion that the rights protected under the First Amendment, you can maybe consider, and you alluded to this a little bit, the idea of freedom of expression. You have the ability to express yourself in a way that allows you as an individual to let your thoughts be known. That said, and as Toussaint also mentioned, we'll talk about some limitations on that. And we actually talked about this at lunch today. You know, your right to express yourself only goes so far. You know, your ability, my ability to speak what we want to say to someone else ends essentially at your listener's ears. You know, you can put out what you want. People don't always have to take it in. But the idea is one that is built upon sharing ideas, expressing yourself freely, and not having the government essentially establish for you what you ought to be thinking, how you ought to be saying, what you ought to be, how you ought to be expressing yourself through speech or religion or how you gather with one another. And I think that's a really important set of rights for us to have, because I think, especially in our society today, we look to the government to do a lot for us. And in some ways, even, I think, try to help us understand how we should think, what we should say, what those messages should be. And that really isn't always the case. And I think in particular on a college campus, especially on a public university campus, you will run into those issues where you want the government, I think, to take a role and query whether that's the appropriate place for that to happen.
I would simply have one addendum. The First Amendment certainly does protect your right to like UNC or to like Duke, I was discussing this with Jonathan on the way down. It specifically does not protect your right to like the University of Florida. All right. Question number two. What does free speech mean? What are the limitations on free speech? And there are some specific examples that have been asked about, so I'll throw them out there so that the panelists can be thinking about them. What about Halloween costumes? What about clothing that has a swastika on it? What about clothing bearing messages saying impeach the president or illegal immigrants are criminals? What about preachers on campus bringing down hellfire and damnation on the people in front of them? What about displays on campus? Maybe big signs with pictures of aborted fetuses on them. I understand that was an issue here in the recent past. What about messages, some of which are not very nice, in the free expression tunnels? Panelists, who would like to jump in on this? What does free speech mean? What are the limits on free speech?
I'll jump in about the Halloween costumes. So we actually had a program here on campus talking about culture versus costume. And I feel like an important thing to remember is that human beings are not costumes. So what that means is you cannot take someone's identity, their life experiences, their emotions, and wear them for a night, and then go out and have fun, and then take that costume off at the end of the night. These people have to live with the ramifications of how you represent them, of how you treat them for the rest of their lives. For example, things like sexy native costumes, so, you know, Pocahontas, images of so-called headdresses, and short dresses are not representative of indigenous people, particularly indigenous women. And indigenous women are murdered at extremely high rates. They go missing at extremely high rates, and they're raped at extremely high rates. So you need to understand that when you do these things, there are real world repercussions for those people that you claim to be representing, that you claim to be dressing up as. So while the university can't do anything about it, the government can't do anything about it, we as a society can do something about it by saying that we're not going to accept this socially. So if you see your friends dressing up in blackface, if you see your friends dressing up as quote-unquote border crossers, you know, call them out, you know, don't hang out with them, don't spend time with people who are violating beliefs that you hold. And if that belief that you hold is that people are human beings and you shouldn't be using their experiences as a mockery, then, you know, you should make that clear to your friends.
It's the difference between the government regulating speech and individuals reacting to speech. The government, and in this case the university, is very limited in how it can regulate speech. For the most part, it cannot regulate speech on the basis of content. On the other hand, that doesn't address the moral issue at all, does it? There are some sorts of speech which really are inappropriate, and the appropriate response to them, as Gabby pointed out, is more speech. And that speech is to tell your friends that this is not cool, not something that you want them to do. And that's how we make progress on these issues. We don't want necessarily the government to be telling us what to say or not say, but certainly our friends and our parents are going to weigh in on that, and our fellow classmates. Yes, question in the back. Could you tell us who you are before you start?
Sure. My name is Brad Best, and I work here at Appalachian State. And so I am curious for the panel, do you view the Constitution as being a document that says what the government can do, or do you view the Constitution as a document that states what the government cannot do?
I think it's important to look at the actual body of the Constitution and regards to both parts of the body that the founders wrote and then the amendments that they compiled as a cohesive unit. And to with your question of regards of really empowering the government and then also limiting them, it's found through the first seven articles of all the powers that are granted to both or all the branches of government and whatever powers it might have. But it's also important to see how many amendments have been written and proposed by Congress. I think if you really think about this Constitution, it's missing an eighth article. I think that eighth article is the amendment section or every single amendment that's been added. We don't see the people or the power of the people anywhere in the Constitution and anywhere in the body of the Constitution. I think that's addressed in however many amendments we're at now. So I guess 27, 28, so 27 amendments.
That's a really fundamental question that you asked. Does the Constitution give the government power or does it limit it? It does both. Primarily, the first seven articles create the government and empower it. In fact, poof, Article 1 creates Congress. Poof, Article 2 creates the president. Poof, Article 3 creates the judiciary. So there's your government. And the real limitations on what the government can do came during the amendment process, and especially during the first 10 amendments, really the first eight, and then some of the post-Civil War amendments as well, tells us that the government can't do things like limit our speech. It can't do things like take away our guns. It can't do things like quartering redcoats in our houses. That's the single most effective constitutional amendment in history. You know that, don't you? Have you ever seen a single redcoat in your house? It works like a charm. Let's get back to question number two, though. We talked a little bit about Halloween costumes, clothing bearing swastikas, preachers on campus. Anyone want to talk about preachers on campus?
I actually want to talk about one of the things that Toussaint brought forward, and this idea of obscenity. And I think it's really challenging because colloquially we talk about obscenity as anything that feels offensive. But as far as I know, and the lawyers here are going to have a better discussion about this than I can, the Supreme Court's really only taken up obscenity in relation to child pornography. Is that correct? Mm-hmm. And so it's really hard because as we look at what is it that we consider obscene, what is it that we consider beyond the bounds of morality, and what it is that we as people and as a society should accept, we really have this idea of what obscenity is or should be that truly the courts have not been interested in talking about. And one of the things I want to also touch on is this idea of we look at the Constitution as being very absolute, right? That it's kind of, it's a settled thing. It has 27 amendments. It has seven articles, the end, right? And it's really not. Even as we think about this life, liberty, and property, that was only really limited to certain people, right? And so as we think about the way that the Constitution was laid out and who was in mind when the Constitution was being written, it really perpetuated particular forms of oppression while trying to alleviate other forms of oppression. And so I think what we see today is that tension of the country today is not made up of the same people who were thought to be the ones making up the country then. And so some of the challenge is how do these rights extend to everybody and different experiences when before those people either were not here or were not seen as part of the everybody. So I think that's a really important question, is this idea of obscenity. What do the courts have to say about obscenity, and particularly, or potentially, what has been missed in terms of discussing this idea of obscenity?
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm on a trip to Boone, North Carolina, where I recently visited Appalachian State University. After the break, we'll have some more from App State. Stick around. Appalachian State University is not only the school that knocked off the University of Michigan's football team some years back. It is also a center of academic excellence nestled in the beautiful mountains of western North Carolina, where they take the First Amendment, free speech, and academic freedom very seriously. At a recent panel discussion as part of the Say What week-long celebration of free speech, I asked some of the people at Appalachian State about that very subject, academic freedom and free speech. Among those I called out on this issue was Michael Barrett, a professor of history at Appalachian State, who had been sitting silently throughout the entire evening.
Michael, I really want to hear from you. I've been waiting for you all evening, and these lawyers and these students and these administrators have just been monopolizing things, so please.
Yeah, that never happens.
Never, ever.
So, my real purpose of being here, I think, is I'm associated with this organization, AUP, and I hope that we get to have a chance to talk about its core issue of academic freedom. But I do want to speak a little bit as a historian or someone who's interested in, of course, in history. That is my profession here. And history doesn't just mean talking about the past. It means thinking about change and the way that change impacts society. And I would just sort of almost like to offer a comment on the very interesting exchange that my fellow panelists just had, which was very interesting, and to say that I think it's indicative of the fact that we are in a difficult and controversial moment in our country as it relates to free speech. One way that I think it's been accurately put is that free speech has actually become a stake in the new culture wars that are currently being fought in this country. Let me give you just a simplistic example of what I mean. I think that if you had looked at American political culture about, let's say, around 30 years ago, maybe even a bit earlier than that, you would have found that roughly speaking, the people who identified as conservative or in the political right would have been precisely the people who said that they thought that free speech should be limited. Mm-hmm. Why? Because they saw free speech as threatening things like political order and morality. To give you one example, as late as 1988, the question of flag burning was a controversy in an American political election, and it was the conservatives who said, free speech is not absolute, it needs limits. And it was the left that said, no, free speech is necessary. It's crucial to being able to make progressive political agendas, and so on. Where we are right now is something, I think, close to a kind of flip of that same situation. I'm just sort of observing the fact that this is taking place, and I think that it's significant. Now you have people, and I know these are loose and imprecise categories, but people who are roughly on the political left, or progressives, radicals, however you want to call them, who are saying precisely there has to be some limits to free speech. I don't want to mischaracterize you or put words in your mouth, but it seems to me that what you were talking about is kind of roughly in that vein. I hope that's not fair. And of course, the issue of hate speech is central to this. And we have people who I think are essentially arguing that not only is hate speech not the same as expression, but that hate speech is actually something that is intended to undermine the values of democracy so fundamentally that it actually prevents some people from really being able to exercise their free speech. But on the other hand, you have people on the right who are now sort of falling back into this kind of hard position of free speech is something that is absolute and must be defended. And I'm certainly not trying to suggest that, Mr. Meggett, that that's the position that you're defending. I know that it's not. But there are forces in our society that are making that, and they've directly impacted our campus. I just want to mention sort of one thing that has happened that I've sort of followed closely recently. In 2017, the North Carolina State Legislature adopted a piece of legislation that was essentially copied from a right-wing think tank called the Goldwater Institute that's called Restore Free Speech in North Carolina. And the UNC Board of Governors, which is the governing body for the UNC system, has adopted this as a policy that to which we are all subject right now. It's called Policy 1300.8. And this is a policy that is designed to kind of defend free speech on campus under the premise that it is under threat, and it forbids administrators from disinviting speakers. It requires universities to be institutionally neutral on matters of public controversy. It subjects you, students, to disciplinary sanctions under certain circumstances if you are seen as violating the expressive rights of others. And we have that law because there is a kind of view among some political forces that all of you have gotten out of hand and that you no longer value free speech and that you're being coddled and that you can't tolerate dissent. That really is the way the argument goes. So I just want to sort of comment that we're in a kind of broader sort of cultural discussion. If I can just sort of say quickly what my recommendation to you in this context is, what you should do if you are interested in effectuating change, if you're interested in protesting, the best thing that you can do is know the laws, know the rules, know the policies. Don't be caught off guard by those. One of the most effective things that you can do if you're going to be challenged by someone, especially in a position of authority, is to know which rules you are subject to and to be able to hold the people who want to throw the book at you to the rules that they are claiming to enforce. So that's my lesson for the evening. Thank you.
Great. And as a final note, please, just as a personal note, don't be painting swastikas on things. It's just not a good idea. Thank you very much for your attention. This has been a wonderful panel. Thank you to all the panelists. Thank you to all the audience.
Well, that was a fabulous panel discussion. I only regret that I wasn't able to include everyone's question in all of the discussion. But there's one other place we have to go. I gave an address, a closing keynote address for the Say What event. I'm going to skip that part because you guys have heard enough of me talking, but I'm going to highlight some of the great questions that we got from the audience. And who are you?
My name is Valerie Kitchell.
Valerie, and you speak right up. Are you a student, Valerie?
I am a student, but I don't go here.
Okay, sit down, Valerie. No. Where are you a student?
I go to Watauga High School.
Now tell me, what is an individual right?
Well, I can certainly try. An individual right is something that you are allowed to do that is stated in the Constitution or the Bill of Rights, or allowed by the Ninth Amendment that's not specifically stated. And it's something that you as a person are allowed to do no matter what.
That's a pretty good definition. Is that a pretty good definition? I say we give her a round of applause. That's good. And she is a high school student. I might amend the definition slightly for reasons that will become clear, although I think everything that was said is probably accurate. Our Constitution is structured in what we call a majoritarian fashion. It's not a democracy, it's a republic. But for the most part, most of our decisions are made by a majority of people, right? Majority rules. It's close to democracy. And democracy's good, right? Democracy's always good. Or is it? We've got, let's say, 100 people in this room. And let's say we drew a line right down the middle, and on one side of the line were 51 people, and on the other side of the line were 49 people. Now, if those 51 people stick together and always vote as a block, they can do some pretty terrible things to the other 49, can't they? They can take away all your property. They can make you do all the work while they get all the benefit. They could essentially turn you into slaves. There's a phrase for this. We call it what? The tyranny of the majority. Majorities can be just as tyrannical as any king or emperor can be. So even though our basic constitutional structure is premised upon majority rule filtered through our representative system of government, people at the time of the adoption of the Constitution realized that this could still lead to tyranny. And so they wanted very much to have individual rights put in the Constitution, literally put in and written in the Constitution. An individual right in this scenario is the ability of one person, the individual, out of a nation that's now, what, 330 million? To stand up to a majority and say, no, you can't do that to me. What are the three basic powers of government? Who can tell me? Who remembers eighth grade civics? Yes? Again, the high school student. Come on back up. Maybe you should just sit up front. Since you're going to be my go-to girl, okay.
Sorry, I have a bad habit of raising my hand in class a lot. The three basic, which?
Powers of government.
Okay, cool. Well, they can make and enforce laws.
Those are two powers.
Oh, okay.
Make law.
Enforce law.
Enforce law.
And, I don't know, judge people.
Judge people. Okay, Valerie, exactly. Every government makes rules. Every government then executes those rules, enforces them. And every government adjudicates disputes that inevitably arise under those rules, the three basic powers of government. Wasn't Valerie delightful? I found out later that she is actually the daughter of Megan Hayes, who does the Sound Effect podcast that you heard earlier in the show. So it's a small world. And I was ultimately not surprised because I'm sure that Megan and Valerie have some very interesting discussions at home. These were some fairly standard foundational questions we've been discussing with Valerie. We did eventually get to some specific First Amendment issues, and we had the benefit of having a young student there from Germany who addressed the issue of whether swastikas and other Nazi-type symbols should actually be outlawed.
I'm from Germany, and we have you know, like drawing the swastika, the Nazi salute, all of that, that is outlawed. You can't do that. Right. You know, you can get prosecuted for that. So I have not studied law in Germany or in the US, but I say there must be a way to define hate speech. Like, we do it, and it's outlawed.
Mm-hmm. You outlaw this display of the swastika, right?
Yeah.
Okay, you outlaw the display of other Nazi symbols, right? Right? Has that destroyed fascism in Germany?
I mean, to a degree, yes.
You think it did suppress it? Or did it just drive it underground?
You would have to find, like, that's an empirical debate. I say it is for sure a very good argument and something the state has to do to say, even if we drive it underground, we as a state will not allow, I mean, specifically Germany, with our history, we will not allow signs of fascism and Nazism. Because, like, if the state allows it, it in a way also, I mean, not appreciates it, but, you know, like, the message the state sends with saying it is not allowed is a very different one from saying, okay, you can do that.
It's kind of hard to argue with the fact that modern Germany outlaws swastikas. Now, I see a hand from a young woman who's been very patient in the back.
So I'm Brooke. I'm a criminal justice major, and I'm a junior. And I just think outlawing any kind of speech might be a slippery slope a little bit, just because it, like we said, hate speech is subjective. So who knows, like, what that could lead to. So I think that could lead to more suppression of speech instead of actually allowing it more.
Hi, my name is Harper Austin. I'm a junior. And I kind of have to agree with Brooke. I think if you say that this and this and this can't be said, then you're creating a harsher divide between people. And then people feel like they can't be heard and they feel more isolated and more likely to draw back into the groups that you're trying to suppress in the first place.
Dr. Hyde, you had your hand up before.
I just wanted to say one of my favorite things that I've seen happen on campus numerous times is when speech and expression is offensive to people, or people feel like it's hate speech or oppressive, they go out and create more speech in opposition to that. And actually, that resulted in me meeting a German Nazi in the 2 days of hate programming put on by AEPI. And that was in reaction to what happened in Pittsburgh and also to what happened in the free expression tunnels. And I thought it was a pretty beautiful thing because he was, I should clarify, reformed Nazi who was talking about his path and his engagement in Germany with other Nazis.
All right, we're getting a little short on time here, so we're going to close with one young woman in the audience who really encapsulated, I think, the conflict that most of us feel when it comes to free speech.
It's frustrating because I know that you're right, but I don't want to agree with you.
You sound like my kid. No, Dad, you're wrong. I don't know why, but you're just wrong.
Because I so strongly believe that what I believe is the right way to believe, the correct way to believe. I just don't like freedom of speech, even though I know that it's what's right and what makes America so great. And so it, like, kind of pisses me off, like, hearing all of this. I know that's kind of, like, I guess immature to an extent. I don't know, but I just feel, like, angry about it right now. So that's all. It's just a comment.
I always like to say, Katie, that if I don't piss people off, I haven't done my job.
I'm Alexa. I'm a sophomore here, and I'm an international criminal justice major. My question was, I know you mentioned, like, Colin Kaepernick, and that's, like, a really big debate in my household because, like, my grandmother's constantly screaming, like, he has to stand. And could there be laws placed in the NFL that could make players stand for the flag?
Thanks for that question, Alexa. Excellent question. The answer is the NFL right now could fire every single person who kneels at these protests. The NFL is a private entity. These are private relationships they have with the players. The only legal problem they might have is whatever the contract says they have with that particular player. And I suspect that, I don't know, I suspect that those contracts have clauses in there that are commonly called morals clauses, that if the player does something either on the field or off the field that puts the NFL in a bad light, that could harm the NFL, that they can be terminated. So I think there's an argument even that they could get through with it contractually. Unfortunately, some of their best players are doing this, and they don't want to fire these players. In fact, Colin Kaepernick, I understand, was a pretty darn good quarterback. So I think that's really where we are right now. It is not a constitutional standoff. It does involve free speech, but in a private context where the Constitution doesn't protect anybody. Interestingly, it's possible to argue
that by actively encouraging the NFL owners to fire these people, these sons of bitches, as he calls them, our president has entwined the government in the person of himself so closely with these private interests that if in fact they followed his advice and fired them, that might actually be considered a constitutional violation because it was done at the behest of a government actor. But right now, no constitutional protection. And think of it this way too. I think, again, I'm trying not to take political sides here, but I believe that our president also expressed admiration from Kim Jong-il, isn't it? Or is it Il Jong? I can't keep the Kim straight. Kim Jong-un, the current Kim, the current fat boy who runs North Korea and, you know, kills people with anti-aircraft guns. A nice, nice guy. He commented how much he admired the fact that everybody stood up whenever they addressed him or whenever he entered the room, and he, maybe jokingly, I don't know, our president said, yeah, I'd like to be able to make people stand up and pay attention when I speak. Well, do you want to live in a country where we can be made to stand and respect the flag? I'm a little bit corny. I get a little bit teary-eyed when I see people singing the national anthem. The reason I feel that way is in large part because they're doing it voluntarily. They're doing it because they love their country. And as soon as you tell them they have to do it under penalty, then how do you know how they feel? You've completely undermined what the flag stands for when you force people to respect it. Okay, Katie, I'm going to let you have the last word.
So there's not a formal penalty right now to kneel during the national anthem, but personally I've felt the desire to not stand during the national anthem, but I felt pressure from everyone around me to stand. And the one time here at the university that I ignored the national anthem playing, I was harassed by someone who chased me down and told me that I was disrespectful. So I think that, like, there may not be a legal penalty, but there is a social penalty, and I think that can be just as cruel and harsh.
I understand that, and you're right. I mean, it's a free speech issue, and you felt that your free speech rights were being denied by the actions of that other person, but that other person wasn't the government, and therefore the First Amendment was not implicated. Okay, well, I've been told in no uncertain terms I better get the hell out of Dodge. Thank you, Dr. Hyde. Thank you, audience, for your participation.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to all the great people at Appalachian State University who invited me to participate with them in their Say What event, their free speech on campus event. What great fun it was. Thanks specifically to Leonie Kruger and her husband, Provost Daryl Kruger. Thanks to Dr. Jonathan Hyde, the Vice Chancellor and Dean of Students. Thanks to Megan Hayes of the Sound Effect podcast. And Dave Blanks and all the great folks at the University Communications Department who helped Megan and me with that. Thanks to our panelists for the panelist discussion on free speech. And members of the audience, especially, I must say, young Valerie of Watauga High School. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by Hannibal's Elephants. Check them out on SoundCloud. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment.